Okay, I'm going to start up again with a differing viewpoint. I think that then get made into messenger RNA, point mutations can happen anywhere in the DNA like you see here. Then there's this lookup table of the genetic code, which converts the information in genomes into information in polymers of amino acids, or the proteins shown here. And there's just the reminder that these point mutations in the DNA sequence may or may not have an effect, because there are many regions, for example, of high redundancy, where a change at the third position of a codon, whether it's UC, A, or G, doesn't matter, and it would have the same amino acid meaning. But there are many other types of changes where, for example, a first and always a second position change would result in a change in meaning and lead to a change in the protein sequence. So this is just our overview so that we all know what the problem is that we're talking about, which is namely, at least in the first half or most of the talk I'll give today, how did this particular mapping come about and what are some of the ways to address that? So first of all, as I was just alluding to, there's a lot of order in the genetic code with respect to, for example, levels of degeneracy, something I'm assuming probably most people are pretty familiar with 64 codons and 21 different meanings including stop. There are many ways in saying the same thing. What's less obvious to those not in this field is that there's so much order otherwise in the genetic code as well. For example, as the color coding scheme here shows, amino acids with similar chemical properties, for example size or charge or polarity, are shown with similar colors. And so you can see, for example, that primarily small hydrophobic amino acids are located in this column containing a U at the middle position. And there are many properties in general of order that are represented in the code. So for example, I've mentioned that these small hydrophobic amino acids all have a U at the second position. I could go through and illustrate many properties of nice order in the genetic code, but in the interest of time, and that one can sort of gather a lot of these properties, in fact, just by staring at the code, I won't mention them. Just the general property first I'll mention is the fact that most related amino acids, or in general degenerate blocks of amino acids of their codons, are accessible by single point mutations, but of course not all. So overall, one might interpret this, for example, as perhaps minimizing the effects of deleterious mutations on protein sequences, or minimizing the effects of mutations overall. And so this will be referred to as the selection model among these three competing explanations, which asks whether the code is optimal, or I should say has been optimized or under the influence of selection in some way. Yes?
Sorry, I just want to stop and ask something. You said in a few slides ago about the code was an emergent property, and I'm wondering if you can distinguish that from a summary statistic in some way, or what exactly do you mean by an emergent property? Are you thinking of this as a...
That was just a footnote on the slide, so I'm simply saying it's something which happened in the origin of life. And since my students made those slides, I won't defend his choice of footnotes. Okay. So basically, I'm presenting an overview of these three competing ways of thinking about the origin of the genetic code. We have natural selection, which I'll say a few things about in a moment. We have stereochemistry, which is going to ask whether certain chemical interactions have shaped the code. And thirdly, which I really won't spend much time on today, is biosynthetic restrictions, which ask whether the code contains some history embedded within it. And there's a member of the audience, Massimo De Giulio, who's here today, who's focused primarily on this aspect of the work. And since he'll be here for the discussion, I'll say the least about it. So these three competing models have been traditionally considered sort of mutually exclusive ways of thinking about how order came about in the genetic code. By saying it came about, I mean it emerged in the genetic code without any rigorous use of something like chaos theory. So an alternative, though, which has been popularized and in fact accepted in textbooks for the past 30 or so years, is whether or not instead the code is merely a frozen accident and therefore requires no explanation. Well, I think just by inspection, we can actually accept that this is not the case by the fact that there's so much order within the genetic code. You wouldn't expect something by chance to have been fixed as a truly emergent property, going back to that quote, if it were just a property of a statistical artifact, essentially. Yet we understand that, of course, it's difficult for organisms to change their genetic codes. And that'll be the subject of the last half, if I get to it today, or the end of the talk tomorrow morning, how genetic codes actually can and do change in real lineages, primarily in microbial eukaryotes like ciliates. So this is going to essentially, from the statistical point of view, serve as our null hypothesis, that the code, in fact, is simply a property of chance. Then we're going to treat independently a little bit of each of these other three competing hypotheses and spend the most time on the latter. So, selection. Now, one thing I should point out is that all three of these explanations are trying to explain why we see the types of order that we do in the genetic code. So, the properties that they're trying to explain, in fact, are the same. The fact that we see small amino acids that have similar properties accessible from one another by single point substitutions. This could be explained on the basis of natural selection, that simply the code minimizes deleterious effects of substitution mutations, and that, in fact, the universal code, the one that was present in the last common ancestor, or LUCA, as it's present here, would be one code which is more fit than most randomized possible variant codes. Now, this doesn't exclude the possibility that one could, for example, solve exactly the best possible genetic code, but that might not be accessible in terms of biological reality. So it's a different question. What we're asking is, can we detect whether there are traces of the history in the genetic code that it has been shaped by natural selection? And these are just some of the people who pioneered this type of research going all the way back to the 60s, shortly after the code was discovered. Yeah. Oh, I'll go through it explicitly in a minute. Okay. So these other two competing theories essentially use different ways to explain also why we would see like amino acids related to each other in the genetic code table. So now a little bit more about natural selection, or what we sometimes refer to as the adaptive hypothesis. Well, the reminder is that point mutations can happen in various places. You can have genuine point mutations in a genomic sequence or in a DNA, which would lead to an altered sequence at the RNA level and then at the protein level if it's in a replacement site in the amino acid sequence. You can also have changes, though, that occur during transcription, such that the mRNA sequence might sometimes differ than the sequence predicted from the DNA. And you can also have mistranslational error. So there are many steps at which the genetic code can and needs to essentially be robust or resistant to various types of errors. And so one would predict, in fact, that some form of error correction would be advantageous in an early genetic code, particularly if early translation evolved in an RNA world or whenever it might have emerged, when error correction by any other proofreading mechanisms was not available. So if, in other words, mutation rates may have been higher, as is plausible in an RNA world, then it would be all the more important to minimize the effects of those types of possible errors. So how can one test, using various statistical and quantitative tools, how our natural genetic code, or maybe the mitochondrial genetic code, or one of those variants, compares against the sort of universe of testable or accessible genetic codes? Well, the trick is fairly simple, and David Hague and Lawrence Hirst pioneered this some 10 or so years ago with some old clumsy computer system where they basically could take the natural genetic code shown in its organization here, swap the codon blocks into this magical mystery hat, and they generated 1,000 variants, which may have had the form, for example, shown on the right. It preserves a level of redundancy, because otherwise one would predict simply that some codes that had more redundancy than others would be better or more fit, as I'll show you the criteria in a moment. Basically, it allows swapping, for example, this switch over here of cysteine from occupying the upper right corner to instead occupying one of the four boxes, or fourfold degenerate boxes of codons. So nowadays, of course, with much more computing power, even a laptop computer can quickly generate 1 million or so possible variant codes. And so one can search and compare the natural genetic code, or any particular genetic code, against this range of accessible variants. So there was already, of course, a question about how does one do such calculations. And I should say, first of all, this is a type of work that Steve Freeland in my lab and formerly when he was in Lawrence Hirst's lab has done. and also David Ardell when he was at Stanford did independently. And the way in general that many of these groups calculate the error value of a code is that if we sort of look at the code here in this three-dimensional representation where we have the first, second, and third base, then if you look at a single codon, for example, UUU for phenylalanine, one can simply look at the other three possible point substitutions that can happen along either the first position, the second position, or the third position, and compare those nine variants to having phenylalanine encoded by UUU. So one first of all needs a scale, I'll come back to this in a moment, which could be something like the polar requirement scale, which is a measure that Carl Woese introduced in the 60s that simply ranks amino acids on a particular scale of polarity. There actually exist many different scales of polarity right now, and one thing that my student Rob Knight recently did as part of the icing on his thesis, which he just finished, was looking at how all of these different polarity measures do compare. But so once you have some measure, then you can say, for example, if you have a swap from phenylalanine to serine by this substitution, well, here's where these two amino acids fall on the polarity scale that we happen to be using. And you can then basically square these differences for all of the nine possible variants. And this is one way of assessing how conservative a particular genetic code be or how error-prone it might be. So summarizing again, I can offer, of course, a website where you can download more information and papers about this type of work for anyone who's interested. Another important factor is to take into account oftentimes weighting transitions more heavily than transversions. And so we can have a natural way of assessing that certain types of changes in the genetic code are more prone to occurring because transitions happen chemically much more often than transversions in any kind of sequence. So also a tool that one of my other graduate students, Drew Ronenberg, has made available is a program he calls GenView, which is a way to essentially create a friendly interface so that any user who's not familiar with constructing programs to generate these variant codes can do so just by clicking. So this is something that should be forthcoming, and there's a paper in Press and Bioinformatics that will describe it and provide the website as soon as it becomes public. So this is essentially going to make available all these tools so that anybody, even a college student, for example, that wanted to do something like this for a project, could make a data set of, say, 1,000 or 1,000,000 variant codes, depending on their computing power, that have any sort of constraints built within them that one might. Now, I'll just simply add the caveat that there still are bugs we're working on in this actual program, so probably won't be perfect. Well, that would be a universe approximately 20 factorial, far too large to actually search. So it's much more reasonable to generate a statistically sampled space, basically of, you know, you can choose a number, 1,000, choose 10,000, or 1,000,000,
and compare them to the present one.
And compare them to the present one, or draw a distribution, as is shown here, of the error values of all of these randomly generated codes. In this case, yes. I mean, one would have to otherwise have a way of sort of normalizing for that, because otherwise a code would simply come out that had more redundancy built within it.
The difference with respect to the present code.
Yes.
Assuming that it is a zero or something.
Right. And in that case, we were using squared differences. One could use absolute value, and one thing that Steve Freeland showed in a paper in Molecular Biology and Evolution was that it didn't matter what modular power one used also in terms of comparing a particular amino acid's either polarity or other scale to the one for which it would be replaced. So a typical result from this type of work, again, which I'm just giving a brief overview of, is that the natural code typically falls out as an outlier in this distribution, not necessarily the best of all possible codes, as some people in this field like to argue, but clearly one which is better than the vast majority of other codes, in fact, probably better than 99.99% or something like that. It's independent typically of what scale is used for polarity, which is good, but one might also then look at different polarity scales, as I mentioned Rob Knight's been doing, and see if certain polarity scales tend to correlate best with optimization or evolution of the code. And perhaps that would indicate which polarity scale is most close a proxy for what natural selection would actually act upon. Terry?
Question, just the biggest one, Matt. How much of the 99.9% would kill me there if you pay no attention to polarity?
Well, I think if you paid no, what do you mean by paid no attention to polarity? Because then what? Would be one. Well, the natural code would still be much better. I don't know. I've never run a simulation like that. It would probably be more of a step function, and the natural code would be quite separate. But then you would simply optimize levels of redundancy if any change is essentially being considered tragic. Terry? Yes. Typically, let me back up. Typically, that's blocked off because we don't know how to, for example, take into account conversion of sense to stop. Although experimentally, that's precisely what we've been dealing with. And that's one of the major modes by which the genetic code evolves, but it's just one that these simulations haven't taken into account because it'd be sort of off scale. Having nothing, we don't know how to quantify that. I mean, if you only look at the stop codons.
Yeah, so sort of to minimize the chance of something.
Well, the stop codons themselves are accessible from here to here, here to here. But that's a smaller scope of the problem to deal just with stop codons. The whole experimental part actually will talk about changes, the molecular basis for how stop codons can change. So I'll put off discussion of stop codons till much later. Any quick questions or any questions you want to save for this afternoon?
Quick question.
Okay.
Do you normalize for the predominance of some amino acids over others?
No. One could take that into account, and that's one of the things that the software would be able to do.
I'm asking that because the probability of
Well, not the probability of mutating to one, but the probability of mutating from one, because you have only one stop codon per gene
but
sequence.
And
you could say zero. Yeah. Yeah, there are so many ways one could play with this. This is why I'm just sort of introducing it as one of a variety of possible terminologies or methodologies for tackling this. Walter?
Just briefly, I'm still not clear about the consequences of this constraining the redundancy of the code. I mean, if you required that all amino acids be coded, why couldn't a different redundancy distribution
Well, it can. It's just that then you would sort of leap into maybe another whole region of genetic code space that was slightly more redundant than the former. So
wouldn't that be important? Isn't that something?
I agree.
That,
yeah.
That would affect silency of mutations.
Yes, it's something I would like to see this kind of software do, but neither Steve nor Drew nor any of the people working on this problem have wanted to work that in so far. So there's a lot of open areas of research.
I can imagine that what would happen is you would want everything to be the same amino acid, which is why it would be important.
It could converge upon everything encoding glycine or something like that, which loses biological meaning.
That would not be a problem if you were to normalize to the
for amino acid usage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's the result, not just the non-English
statement. Go on.
Is the result not just synonymous with saying that you have a blockwise arrangement of the code? That if you take this kind of block arrangement that you showed the previous time, and you jump things out in a completely random fashion, of course you'll get a worse code.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's another viewpoint, which is true, that if you completely randomized or broke up and split apart these blocks, and there'd be too much of this code space that would be junk, because then you could include ones that had amino acids scattered all over the place instead of preserving at least some level of threefold and fourfold redundancy. Okay, but again, I'm just introducing that as one approach to studying the genetic code, which is sort of all in silico, making this possible simulation space of different types of genetic codes. This other viewpoint, which I'll say the least on, code coevolution, we did have a paper recently on this in PNAS, and here's my website, tilde LFL, for anybody who wants to download some of these reprints. And I won't have time to talk about this here, and like I said, Julio is really an expert within this field. And if you're interested, I can, of course, give anybody a pointer, but it's an interesting and intriguing theory which takes into account that if the genetic code started off with fewer than 20 amino acids, it's very natural that as expansion of the genetic code took place, coupled with metabolic expansion in some type of primitive lineage, it would have been natural for certain amino acids to co-opt the codons that had been previously assigned, perhaps to their metabolic precursors or related amino acids. It's an alternative, it's a completely competing explanation, which could also explain, in principle, why we see related amino acids being close to each other in the genetic code table. It might be because of history instead of selective constraints. So it's a competing way of thinking about how these amino acid patterns could have been mapped out in the genetic code. And here's, again, a collection of a few references to some of the seminal papers within this field. There are many different ways, though, of thinking about how metabolism might have left its imprint in the genetic code. And so I won't go into the detail. And I'm going to instead focus most of the next 15 or so minutes on the influence of stereochemistry, because it's the one that we've done the most work in. And stereochemistry, again, was proposed as early as the mid-60s, first by Pelkin Welton, and also by Carl Woese about the same time, which is that simply these direct or straightforward chemical interactions might assign similar codons to similar amino acids. Now, recall that we're talking about here a world that's pre-tRNA. So we don't mean interactions with the tRNA or interactions with the tRNA synthetase, but actually instead direct chemical interactions between the polymers of RNA and the units of amino acids. So it's a very initially speculative yet intriguing theory. And there are many ways to formulate it. In fact, Pelkin-Welton formulated this by looking at models of RNA associated with amino acids, but they happen to have the helix of RNA drawn backwards, yet the theory has still stuck. And there are many ways in which you can model interactions between RNA and amino acids. In fact, there's so many ways in which you can perform such modeling that it essentially left no regard for any of them, because you could model things any which way you wanted and draw different conclusions. And so instead, it's much more satisfying, at least to those of us who are experimentalists, to look to experimental data to support or to provide at least better evidence for particular types of ways of viewing this theory. So the first piece of still speculative evidence, I would say, came in 1989 when Mike Yaris observed that the tetrahymena, that's a ciliate, its self-splicing group 1 intron, has a guanosine binding site within it. And actually, you haven't seen much about this group 1 intron because you've seen a lot so far on instead the class 1 ligase that David Bartel and Peter and Rao and others have worked on. But the first self-splicing RNA, or first catalytic RNA, that was discovered was the tetrahymena group 1 intron, which Tom Cech discovered and won the Nobel Prize for. And this group 1 intron has the property that it uses a guanosine cofactor to facilitate its own splicing. And in that guanosine binding site, you can actually instead bind the amino acid arginine. And then another curious property was that over 99% of the time, there are three nucleotides that make up that guanosine binding site, and they're typically arginine codons. So this was one of those sort of, I'd say, intriguing pieces of suggestive evidence. Although it was published in Nature, and so, sorry?
How many arginine codons are there?
There are six. So CGN plus AGR. So, sorry? Well, the thing is, when you look at the phylogenetic distribution of group 1 introns over all life, they still conserve the property of using three nucleotides that together make up an arginine codon greater than 99.9% of the time. So that's highly significant. But another strange feature about that guanosine binding site, which is why I won't go into it further, is that it's actually not made up of three contiguous nucleotides, but it's made up of two from over here and one from over here that are adjacent to one another in three-dimensional space in the structure of the intron, but not actually in the polymer of RNA. So
ADR,
Yes, of course that's meaningful. But it's not the same in Hebrew. So, going back to our alphabetical questions. Right, it's it wouldn't want to, but chemically, at the level of looking at a guanidino group that would be this part of the structure of guanosine, it's simply chemically similar to the structure of arginine. So one can invoke chemical explanations for why there's similarity between the amino acid arginine and the base guanosine. But I'll show you some pictures later of structures. The key point here is that this was sort of suggestive evidence, yet very implausible evidence to start off with, that there was a direct association available between an RNA motif that could comprise a codon and between an amino acid like arginine. Yet the amusing thing is that this intriguing preliminary result was published in the 80s in Nature, and so when anybody ever tried to publish anything further on the subject in Nature, they simply said, oh, we already showed that was true in 1989. So the question, though, really is how did such an interaction take place? What we're proposing and discussing is whether or not sequence motifs like the codon, which are now found within the context of a messenger RNA encoding protein-coding sequences, whether these could have had some direct association with the amino acid that's actually now located out here at the 3' end of the acceptor stem of the tRNA that associates with it. So it's highly improbable when you think about this, but on the other hand, in the world pre-tRNA, then there wouldn't have been such constraints that the tRNA molecule that's shown very simply here would act as the adapter. But yet I did mention that there have been many ways of modeling how interactions between nucleic acids and amino acids could have helped give rise to the genetic code. In fact, there have been so many ways of modeling it. One can model associations between amino acids with codons, anticodons, other specific motifs on the tRNA, and even codon-anticodon double helices that essentially led no credence to any of the models because there are so many ways of viewing it, at least in silico. So the way to approach this type of problem instead is to use in vitro selection, like we've heard about three or so talks on so far, to simply take an uneducated pool of random RNA sequences, select those which specifically bind to a column that has an amino acid, such as arginine or another one, coupled to it, and preferentially amplify those molecules that can be essentially educated to bind the amino acid from a naive starting point of completely random sequences. So besides the fact that we have the naturally occurring group 1 intron in arginine that can bind, get combined arginine at its guanosine binding site, there are other examples of RNA molecules that bind to arginine-rich protein motifs. So actually, there's been a lot of interest in RNA interactions with arginine, which has been terrific from our point of view because 5 independent laboratories then did experiments where they selected for RNA molecules that could bind to the amino acid arginine. And those references are listed here. 2 of them were in Mike Yaris' lab at Boulder. 1 was in Michael Femelok's lab in Germany. And another one was in Frankel's lab at UCSF. And also this other experiment at UCSF. So basically 3 laboratories, 5 independent experiments, all together looked at different ways in which random RNAs could associate with the amino acid arginine. And this is, again, the schematic of how one takes the initial pool of completely random sequences. For those of you that might have missed, for example, Larry Gold's talk. And from completely random sequences, one washes away those RNA molecules, for example, that might bind to the column matrix instead of specifically to the amino acid, traps those that specifically bind to the positive column, which would have the amino acid such as arginine bound to it as a free amino acid. And also one typically elutes those molecules with a 1 millimolar or so solution of the amino acid so that one gets specific competitive elution of the ligands, the RNAs, off of the column. And one does this over and over again such that if you start off with a population size of, say, 10 to the 14th or 10 to the 15th unique sequences, one winds up in the end with an enriched pool that has an enhanced ability to bind the amino acid arginine. So the term for these molecules, like Larry Gold used, is called aptamers, from Latin aptus, to bind. And this is a general class of molecules that can be selected from random sequence pools to bind specific targets. The hypothesis is that they should reliably contain any signature binding motifs for associating with the amino acid, and it allows us to have a way of testing these different stereochemical hypotheses that I'll show you. So I should say that I'm going to talk mostly about aptamers to arginine, but they've been selected to a variety of other amino acids now. There's also more unpublished data that we've been analyzing from Mike Yaris' lab, and one thing that should be shown here is tyrosine, which was published last year. Now, I'm going to focus mostly on the interaction, or at least the statistical evidence for an interaction between the amino acid and its codons for arginine, but I'll add curiously that such a result also seems to be holding true for both isoleucine and tyrosine, but with a variety of caveats I'll say at the end.
Has the school that binds well arginine been, has this been tested against other amino acids?
Yes. And it's very specific for arginine. The tyrosine one, on the other hand, is not specific for tyrosine. So we've seen a few RNA secondary structures over the course of the past few weeks and earlier in the program. And here I'm showing you the secondary structure of one such RNA that Yang and al. Studied and saw the crystal structure of in Michael Famelok's lab in Germany. This particular RNA basically has a structure where there are some canonical base interactions like AU base pairs and CG base pairs and a few non-canonical base interactions like GG and GA, but it has overall a secondary structure like the one shown here. I should add that Eric Westhoff was involved in solving this structure. Now, the nucleic acids, though, that are important for binding are the ones shown in the white, and the ones shown in yellow are really just sort of more structural scaffolding of the molecule. This is not... Yes, it is with down arginine. It'll be in a couple of slides. So it might, that's true, it might be cooperative, it might be a sort of cooperative binding effect, but basically the arginine binds right in here. I'm showing you the secondary structure now, and I'll show you the tertiary structure in a couple of slides after making a point. So if we look at these arginine binding sites, which is the portion of the molecule shown in white, one key feature to analyze is where are the arginine codons, the CGN motifs or the AGR motifs, where N is any of the four letters and R is appearing A or G. Where do they occur in this sequence? Well, here's one, AGR, AGR, CGN, CGN, AGR, and CGN. So one thing which is striking, and this is an exception rather than the rule, is that this particular molecule is essentially little more than a polymer of arginine codons. It's just really one after another. Now, another striking observation about this particular aptamer, again, one of the five published experiments, is that something about the history by which Michael Famelok selected this aptamer is that was actually selected by conversion of a citrulline aptamer to an arginine aptamer. Here's the difference between the amino acids citrulline and arginine. You can see it's very slight, the difference of a carbonyl group here for the amino group here. It's somewhat analogous to the fact that Larry Gold mentioned that that RNA aptamers can distinguish subtle chemical differences like the difference between caffeine and theophylline. So again, here we have very subtle discrimination at the molecular level in these RNA molecules. But the key thing is that only three base changes were required to convert the citrulline aptamer to the arginine aptamer, and they're the ones shown here in red. And together, those three changes contribute to two new codons encoding arginine. So one, again, sort of striking observation is that, in order to convert the citrulline aptamer to one that binds arginine, it does so by acquiring two new arginine codons. Now, more strikingly, if we do look at the NMR structure in solution with the associated bound amino acid, then you can see, for example, that those three residues that changed, this G, C, and A, are at positions or poised in such a way that they make very snug hydrogen bonding contacts directly with the amino acid. And the same is true over here for the alternative identities that those residues associating with the amino acid citrulline. So essentially, there's no closer way that RNAs could associate with amino acids. Well, now this is the portion that's common to all amino acids, and the contacts are over here. Yes. So it's in the guanidyl group. In this next slide? Yeah. Well, the point is that they make contacts with the differing portions of the citrulline and arginine amino acids. Yes, yes, they are all to the residue. So the residue or the guanido portion of the arginine is that here. Mm-hmm. And that's important to note, it's not recognizing the part that would be common to all amino acids, but not in the backbone also, because this is a free amino acid, as opposed to an amino acid as a side chain. Okay, so our statistical approach to addressing this problem was to ask, is it significant overall for all of the published aptamer data for which there's some structural information available that the binding sites and not the rest of the molecule should show an excess of arginine codons? So to address this, we looked at all the available data and asked whether each nucleotide was found in the binding site or not in the binding site, and then scored whether it was also in an arginine codon or not in an arginine codon. And as I was sort of conveniently blocking over here, the statistical significance of such an association is actually astoundingly large. That is, the probability that such an observation would have occurred by chance is only approximately 3 in a million. And in fact, even when corrected for various constraints like the purine richness of these molecules, the p-value couldn't be reduced, for example, to something below or that is something greater than 10 to the minus 4th. So it's a very robust association. Furthermore, if you look not just at the arginine amino acid, or sorry, the arginine codon set, but at all 21 possible sets, which include all 20 amino acids and also the set of codons, three codons encoding stop, and test whether any other codon block shows an association in this case of these arginine aptamers, then the answer is no, because what you see over here is the G value, since it's analogous to chi squared, but this is the G test for association which we used. If it gets out here to this gray bar, then the p-value would be greater than 0.01. On the other hand, you can see that we have a tremendous amount of significance for arginine and almost no significant correlation for any of the other amino acids. The next greatest would be perlene, but it's still below the orange bar, which would mean, sorry, one of these should be p greater than 0.1, which would be the one here. Yes. Yes. Yes, because to do such a test, you have to pool them all together. It's surprising, though, but even the one aptamer I showed you would be statistically significant all on its own, but that wouldn't be a reasonable test. John? I'll show you that in the next slide. So there was structural information available for five of them, but from the five independent experiments, another thing to do is to look at how the data could have been influenced had we chosen another one of those aptamers that had been sequenced but hadn't been solved, say, for its structure. I'll show you that in a second. So, in fact, I'll show you it right here. The idea is that what you have, for example, is the secondary structure of a representative aptamer solved from one publication in a laboratory, but this represents the assumed secondary structure for a whole composite of aptamer sequences that can be shown down here in alignment. So one question you can ask then is also an evolutionary one about conservation, which is, are the arginine codons conserved in these aptamers? And we can make the very weak assumption that every aptamer that was selected in the same experiment actually has the same structure associated with it. If one does so, and if one looks at these five independent experiments and the complete data sets for each, then there are actually 30,000 possible combinations of five aptamers that we could have chosen at random, one from each of those five experiments. And to show how robust this particular result was, if we looked at the distribution of different possible codon sets across all of these 30,000 combinations, only the arginine amino acid codon set was consistently overrepresented, which is a set here shown in white. And so, in other words, if we looked instead for an association between leucine with this randomized set of 30,000 possible aptamer sequences, that would sort of fall somewhere in this red distribution of everything overall. What this was a response in the April issue of RNA last year in 2000 to various criticisms that had come back from the earlier result, which was published in Chemistry and Biology, because it's treading on thin ice to approach an area where we can actually say with strong statistical correlations that we support a particular theory about the origin of the genetic code. that there would have been a direct chemical interaction that interplayed between the amino acid arginine and perhaps others with its codons so early in evolution. So a lot of people took strong disagreement. But this showed at least that the association itself and the data sets we were analyzing were fairly robust, despite the fact that some of these individual arginine codons would disappear in some of these sampled sequences. So to summarize some of these observations, a variety of controls were very important. For example, looking at whether or not CGN and AGR, the arginine codon sets, were more overrepresented than their permuted codons, which would be GCN and GR, just to make sure that it wasn't a compositional effect. And again, it turned out to be the case that the permuted codons were not significant. We also found in general that it wasn't just a factor of the purine richness that was contributing to the enrichment for arginine codons. We also tested these other hypotheses I mentioned, which showed that no more arginine anticodons were present than expected, nor any of those other motifs that I mentioned that were part of today's tRNAs. It was very important also to look at non-arginine aptamers, that is, RNA molecules selected to bind either other amino acids or small molecules like caffeine or theophylline, like Larry Gold talked about. At that time, there were structures available at the level of resolution that I showed you earlier for about 5 different non-arginine aptamers. And so we looked at all of them, and none of these aptamers selected to other targets had a strong association with arginine codons in their binding sites. So it's not simply a property that these motifs make up better binding sites for small ligands either. And furthermore, we also looked at any other possible 4+2 codon block, in the sense that arginine is a block of 4, CGN, and a block of 2, AGR. And you can look at many possible ways of combining 4+2 in the genetic code table. And none but the arginine set, again, or ones that overlapped with the natural arginine set, had a strong association. John? Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but I think somebody has probably looked at it. Yeah. This is to illustrate what I meant by 4+2, because arginine here is this block of 4 plus this block of 2. If you swap around all possible combinations of 4+2 in the genetic code table, then again, this is a robust way of showing that none showed an association stronger than arginine. It also shows, this particular slide shows just yet another property of order in the genetic code, which is that these two small acidic amino acids differ only at the third base position and share a codon block. There are many such properties like these throughout the genetic code. So the conclusions that we can draw from this particular study are fairly intriguing. First of all, the basic conclusion is that the arginine binding motif itself is codonic rather than anticodonic, meaning using the anticodon or using one of these other motifs. This suggests intriguingly that the codon amino acid associations as viewed here may have actually contributed to or helped establish the present genetic code assignments, not just some ancient predecessor, because for whatever reason, in all of the variant codes today, or I shouldn't say on all the variant codes, but in the universal genetic code it's referred to, at least in the last common ancestor, the same properties of having arginine at the 4-block CGN and the 2-block AGR is preserved. So it's almost suggestive of the fact that such rules might have been set down based on simple chemical forces very early in evolution, some 3.9 billion years ago, and yet preserved all the way through the present. Now, the fact is that we don't have enough amino acids that are arginine in most protein sequences to merit the use of all 6 codons. So sometimes those codons get reassigned to other amino acids. But in general, when arginine does occupy 6 codons in a genetic code, it's the same ones. Terry?
Can you remind me where is arginine?
Okay, it's here.
No.
CGN?
Amino acid.
On what?
On amino acid without
arginine. Pretty. Middle, okay. Some people would argue late. This would say arginine, we would not argue that arginine was early. There's simply the most data available for arginine, though. If we had as much data available for any of the other 20 amino acids, it'd be also intriguing to test whether such an association holds for putative early amino acids versus late amino acids. But right now, essentially, there's no way of testing that just yet. Well, arginine, first of all, has the chemical property of having a lot of groups on it that combine to nucleic acids. It's also positively charged. But independently, groups have selected for lysine aptamers, which is also a positively charged amino acid, and failed in parallel experiments that have worked for arginine. So it's not simply a property. Failed as in no aptamers emerged, yes. So for every selection which works, there are many oftentimes that don't, and you don't hear me or Larry Gold talking about them. The same statistical analysis or same selection? Well, okay, I can describe that. So let me see what I have on the slides next first. Okay, I'll back up. What's intriguing is that this result is very strong for arginine. There's no data set of aptamers as robust for any other amino acid, so I'll first start with that caveat. But there's a pretty good data set of amino acid aptamers that bind isoleucine and tyrosine and some of the other amino acids that I showed you earlier. And it had been published in the literature that at least for isoleucine and for tyrosine, both papers published in the journal RNA, that there was again an association between the codons and the binding sites for the amino acid, as inferred by chemical experiments. Yet, the authors of those experiments didn't look for binding site associations with other motifs. And so when my student Rob Knight recently reanalyzed these, he found that the association with the codons is strong for isoleucine and for tyrosine, but they also bind to their anticodons. So it seems to be the case that we need, first of all, incredibly much more data for the other other amino acids. And this is something that Mike Yaris' lab at Boulder is scaling up to do some type of massively parallel aptamer search, although Ron Breaker's also tried something similar. And it still seems to be the case that aptamers are not easily selected for all 20 amino acids. Some continually fail. But it's very curious that arginine should show such a strong association with its codons and not its anticodons, and yet at least for these two other amino acids for which there's what I would consider preliminary but pretty solid data, with isoleucine and tyrosine, there's an association with both the codons and the anticodons, which could fit either of three models, either the association between the RNA sequences and the amino acid via the codons, the anticodons, or there was a third hypothesis there, which was a codon-anticodon double-stranded region alternating.
Would have been in this original RNA world, and the proteins would have made of these specific amino acids that can bind to these specific codons, and then eventually once that transfer over to...
Well, let me show you a few scenarios. I want to back up and say a few things, which is that if the association between codons and arginine very strongly supports that arginine should at least in some ancestral genetic code occupy these six codons, or this purple block shown over here. And let's say that the association is reasonably strong enough after more data are gathered for isoleucine that it should either occupy this block here, or perhaps its anticodon block, and that the same thing holds up for tyrosine, although one problem with the tyrosine aptamers is that they also bind to a few other small hydrophobic amino acids. In general, it might be the case that because natural selection is acting in combination with chemical forces, that a few constraints that are dictated by chemistry might and should be enough that in combination with modeling that one can do on the basis of either metabolic expansion, for example, or just simple chemical relatedness, that the whole genetic code becomes predictive once you have information available about the chemistry, about the way in which natural selection would shape codon assignments, and perhaps about code expansion, if that also played an influential role. It's hard to distinguish the difference between that and natural selection. So a variety of people, including Guy Sella and David Ardell, who recently both graduated from Stanford University, have been doing modeling. And Guy Sella is now at the Weizmann, and David Ardell is now in Sweden, in Uppsala, in the Center for Molecular Evolution. Their work has shown that actually when one does construct models sort of ab initio with these types of constraints built into them, then one actually begins to predict the overall shape of the genetic code as it's found. And that's rather important, yet still a theoretical model. The last few points I wanted to make here are that the observation that these strong codon relationships, for example, between arginine codons and its ability to bind the amino acid arginine, appearing in the complex of in the context of a complex RNA molecule, are highly suggestive of an RNA world origin for the genetic code. So a question that some people asked Larry Gold or others who've talked about aptamers here is, what is the potential biological use of an aptamer, one of these molecules selected from random sequences today to have the property of binding some target molecule or the ligand? Well, the argument in general is that only in the RNA world would there have been such a possibility or an opportunity for random RNA molecules to interact with ligands in such a way that had, at that point, biological meaning. And so it suggests that this stage in the evolution of the genetic code could have actually been driven by nucleic acid protein interactions at the level of molecules like these aptamers. In other words, they may in fact be reminiscent of the hands, their gloves, that could have initially bound to such amino acids. And it gives us a sense a little bit about the possible dating of the origin of the genetic code. So there have been these three models I've talked about, two primarily, stereochemistry, there's also coevolution, and then there's adaptation via error minimization. And traditionally, these have been viewed, as I said, as competing explanations, but an alternative of viewing them as antagonistic forces would be to view them as rather synergistic evolutionary forces, which would be such that at the time of the origin of the genetic code, chemistry might have had the largest influence, and then gradually adaptation was consistently important throughout all evolution up to the point of the last common ancestor and ongoing, for example, in mitochondria, where there are many changes still occurring, and in ciliates that I'll talk about tomorrow. And code expansion probably took place somewhere here in the middle between the origin of the code and the time of the origin of the last common ancestor. And so it's important to view how these forces can also act together. Yes?
The thing that I'm having trouble with is in terms of this,
how to fit
towards mutations and how that would give organisms a selective advantage, whatever, is that the whole idea I'm trying to fit that in with a mechanism in terms of how that would work. I mean, I can imagine that if there were two competing organisms with different genetic codes, then an organism with a genetic code that was more robust would possibly outcompete an organism with a different genetic code. But I find it hard to believe that there were different species of organisms with different genetic codes competing against each other in terms of fitness. So I don't know how to take this robustness of the code and make it into a mechanism for how it would actually evolve that way, as to optimize this particular property.
Well, the fact that you have a difficulty imagining a stage in evolution when species or organisms could have been competing that had different genetic codes is somewhat irrelevant, because we must sort of take for granted that some stage in evolution like this had to have happened. The code wasn't simply laid down by a great deity that said the genetic code was going to be as such. And so it had to have arisen through the combination or subset of these different forces, chemical, selective, and primitive metabolism. So yes, I agree, it's difficult to imagine a scenario. That's why also these two population geneticists, Sell and Ardell, have been looking at population genetic models, whereby, getting in stereo, whereby basically if you have a small selective advantage associated with one genetic code over another, that you can compete organisms. That's very likely too. Like in Carl Willis has a nice scenario where there was sort of what I refer to as a kind of kibbutz of genotypes interacting together before the trifurcation of archaea, bacteria, and eukarya.
And so I'm having trouble understanding how the mechanism of selective advantage for robustness occurred prior to organisms and prior to species and things like that. I don't know how that works actually mechanistically.
Well, I can refer you to a paper by Carl Woese, I think in 98 in PNAS, if you just do a search on Woese in PNAS for reprints. where he does outline some speculative arenas where there could have been these conglomerate genotypes that might have essentially been able to buy into a common pool of resources if the entrance fee was that they use the same genetic code. So there are many, many ways of thinking about this. One has to sort of borrow tools from population genetics and other ways of thinking about emergent properties and metabolism, but it gets tricky, and there's no agreement in this field on such issues. The last point I want to make, though, is about a question you asked earlier, and it's probably in many people's minds, how mechanistically could any type of chemical interactions shape the genetic code? Well, the first and simplest explanation is the one that Mike Yaris has been promoting, called the direct templating hypothesis, or DRT for DIRT. So this assumes, for example, that amino acid binding sites could have arisen in small RNA molecules that have the amino acid, for example, bound to the center, and that direct templating might crudely have taken place by the proximity of multiple amino acid aptamers bringing into nearness the actual amino acid. So the aptamers that initially had binding sites within them for the amino acids could have essentially been early adapters. These might have had some activity or been coupled to ribozymes in the same way that ribozymes can be involved in the laboratory, like you saw from Peter and Rao, where you couple two domains to each other, such that maybe a self-aminoacylating motif arose in RNA, and then that aminoacylating motif, if it becomes coupled to a handle that can bind to a specific amino acid, could become an early self-charging tRNA that can bind to the amino acid onto itself. This could, in a very crude way, lead to some kind of direct templating mechanism that might have given rise to a mechanism that looks more like today's present tRNAs associated with the amino acids at one terminus and the anticodon at their base. Very, very loose, I'll add, but this is just a summary, basically, of one way of viewing Mike Yaris's model. Esh Zathmary has proposed a different way of thinking about the utility of binding to amino acids in an RNA world. Basically, I would describe this as the role that cofactors like coenzyme A and FAD and NAD play in modern chemistry could have been inverted in the RNA world, and small amino acids could have played instead the role of coenzymes in the RNA world, and that little handles of molecules that have, for example, perhaps a codon or an anticodon motif on them and an amino acid associated with it, perhaps covalently bound, could have initially been a way to help incorporate and enhance catalysis in chemistry by introducing amino acids specifically into functional RNA molecules. So this coding coenzyme notion from Zathmary suggests that there are some functional RNA molecules here that have a way of grabbing onto the handle of an RNA which is bound to a particular amino acid. And this could have ultimately, but I admit here, albeit very sloppily, given rise to some type of oligopeptide formation, leading ultimately to having fused amino acids or short peptides associated with these RNAs. It's sort of like envisioning an early ribonucleoprotein world where there could have been fusions of RNA molecules and short peptide molecules. Well, one synthesis that we've proposed, that is with my student Rob Knight, is that just again putting these models together, one can envision possibly that aptamer-like molecules could have evolved, again, this property of binding to specific amino acids. These could have become coupled to another RNA motif that could become the self-charging or self-aminoacylating catalytic RNA or ribozyme. Ultimately, just to gloss through fairly a bit, if it was selectively advantageous to incorporate specific amino acids into early RNA chemistry, one way, for example, might be that polyarginine, because it's so positively charged, would help neutralize the backbone of RNA, and that could help incorporate RNA molecules into vesicles. So there are many plausible scenarios where one can envision the utility of incorporating some amino acids either into early metabolism or catalysts. And of course, the amino acids have an enhanced variety of functional groups, and so they could play good roles as cofactors. And so selection could have act on enhanced specificity of binding between RNA molecules and amino acid molecules. And again, gradually this, you know, great leap in transition of evolution occurs, and ultimately this could have fed into, through many other steps, the role of adapters today used in translation that have an amino acid at their acceptor stem and also have the presence of an anticodon. Walter?
It might be worth pointing out an intriguing idea that Massimo has proposed some 20 years ago of the origin of transRNA, in which he postulates that it arose through a gene duplication of original sort of thing that might look like your aptamers, and if the binding site that recognizes, you know, the codons that recognize the amino acid are in the right position, then by duplication and by making the covalent structure, then you would get nice and anticodon.
Yes. Yeah, there's actually been a lot of discussion about whether tRNAs evolved by duplications. From Nancy Maisels and Alan Weiner as well, who have proposed different roles for the top and bottom halves of the tRNA in evolution, and also as early as from John Hopfield some 20-some years ago also, made some observations about tRNA. So again, it's hard to prove something like that, but it's indeed plausible that the different domains of the tRNA had different origins. So I think here I'm simply wrapping it up and saying there'll be much more discussion on this afternoon at 2, probably in the room next door. Is that right? And tomorrow morning, also as part of the talk I'll give on gene rearrangements, I'll focus also on modern changes in the genetic code, because within some lineages of unicellular eukaryotes, namely ciliates, there have been tremendous changes in the genetic code, as many as 4 different genetic codes existing in a single group of microorganisms. And we'll talk about the mechanistic basis for how ciliates can have changes in their genetic code, all underlyingly in one single protein substitution. And the work that I talked about today was primarily that of my graduate student Rob Knight and a postdoc Steve Freeland, but also part of the graduate work of Drew Ronenberg in my lab, and I put my website up here where you can get any of the reprints. Thanks.